Welcome to Stories of Safety. In this podcast series, we will talk to the people who have shaped healthcare safety. We will explore the stories, science, and policy that have shaped how we think about, manage, and measure the safety of healthcare. This series is funded by the National Institute for Healthcare Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. I'm Jane O'Hara. I've been a patient safety researcher for over 15 years. In this time, I've come to understand how complex healthcare is and how difficult it can be to answer one seemingly simple question. How safe are we and how can we improve? In this series, we will be exploring this deceptively simple question from all angles with people who have helped shape healthcare safety in the UK and across the world. In this episode, we are talking about some key patient safety issues over the last two decades, the burden of diagnostic error and what we can do about it, and the importance of considering patient safety when developing, implementing, and using information technologies in healthcare. We will also be touching on an emerging issue that is likely to become increasingly important to the patient safety community, namely the impact of patient safety initiatives on environmental sustainability. To do this, I'm delighted to be joined by one of the world-leading experts on these important issues, an award-winning clinical academic from across the pond, Professor Hardeep Singh. So just a little bit of information about you, Hardeep, for our listeners. So Dr. Hardeep Singh is a multi-award-winning scientist and professor of medicine at the Michael DeBakey Veterans Affairs Medical Center and Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Hardeep leads a portfolio of multidisciplinary patient safety research related to measurement and reduction of diagnostic errors, improving the use of health information technology, and health system transformation. His research has informed several national and international patient safety initiatives and policy reports, including those by the National Academies, the CDC, the OECD, and the World Health Organization. His more recent contributions include system strategies and policy-level approaches for accelerating climate action and environmental sustainability in healthcare. And he has received several prestigious awards for his pioneering work, including the 2021 John M. Eisenberg Patient Safety and Quality Award for Individual Lifetime Achievement, which is an amazing biography there, Hardeep, and we are absolutely delighted that you found time to speak to us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll kick off with what I like to ask people on my podcast now is to start off with a bit of sense of place. So where were you born, Hardeep?
Oh, I was born in New Delhi, India. I grew up in New Delhi and did my training there too.
Amazing. And one particularly interesting thing I discovered about you in planning for this podcast was that you, amongst the awards that you've been given, you were awarded the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers from the then President Obama in 2014, which is an amazing achievement. But we're all thinking, what was it like to meet Barack Obama? What was he like? And what was that like to receive that from him?
Oh, that was fantastic. It was It was one of those honors of a lifetime. Got to go to the White House, got to go to several official events. We had our photographs taken. There were about 100 of us. We had a photograph taken in the East Room in the White House, which is sort of where all the dignitaries are sort of hosted. And of course, you know, the president was running a little late. So we were just waiting around, chatting with each other, chatting to all the sort of Secret Service agents. And when the president came up, they lined us up. And as soon as he entered, said, "Sorry for making you late. It's Mr. Putin's fault because he kept me on the phone."
That was a good reason why he was late. So yes, Mr. President, you're excused.
Absolutely. That's amazing. Yeah. I'm so jealous. Yeah, what a wonderful achievement, though. Fantastic. So you're the first clinician that we've spoken to on this podcast. You're a doctor. What's your specialty? What do you specialize in?
So I'm a general internist. I started off my medical career as a primary care doctor, so like a GP. When I finished my residency in telemedicine from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, practiced for a few years in rural East Texas as a primary care doc. And as a primary care physician, I kind of saw a lot of patients who were the ones who inspired me to take on patient safety and to take on diagnostic error. And then I never specialized because I started doing a master's in public health and I wanted to do research. And lo and behold, thankfully, I found a topic that I wanted to focus on, which was general enough. So I actually never specialized and did any training in any, you know, all my colleagues went into cardiology, hematology, oncology, but I stayed on as a general internist. And I still do some hospital work in general internal medicine.
That's so interesting. So what got you started, what got you interested in doing sort of patient safety research then?
Yeah, so you know, when I came into US, I wanted to do research. I just didn't know what research was like and what I wanted to focus on. So I had some federal obligations to complete my visa requirements. So I was practicing in East Texas and I said, well, I need to do something useful with my life in addition to practice. And I started doing this what we call distance learning masters of public health. I think you all call it correspondence. At least we used to in India, the British India. The word was you do it, but the course by correspondence.
Ah, yes.
And at that time it was by mail. And so this is like late 90s and internet was just taking off. And so I started off this master's. I got interested in some of the public health issues. And then when I was seeing all these patients, and I had so many patients who had diagnostic errors, I clearly remember a patient who came to me and said, I'm here because I heard you're the new doctor in town. My old doctor left and I want you to give me my iron shots. I said, so why are you taking shots of iron? He said, I get them every month because I have low iron. Of course, you should know that. And I said, why do you have low iron? And he said, well, because I have anemia. I've been getting shots for 5 years every month of iron supplement. It was an intravenous injection. And so I asked him if he had a colonoscopy to look for colon cancer. And he said, what's a colonoscopy? And so I said, well, so you need a colonoscopy because at your age, you know, one common cause of so much anemia is colon cancer. You can get bleeding. And sure enough, he had a colon cancer that had been missed for, 5 years or so. And I'd see several other patients like that. And I was inspired to figure out, why do these things happen? Are there any system constraints? Are there any cognitive issues? I was very interested in decision making, even in medical school. So I did my med school in All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi. And one of the things we learned from our professors was, history and physical exam and basic clinical skills will get you the diagnosis in most of the patients. And, diagnosis was a big deal. We used to spend hours on trying to debate, what the diagnosis could be based on very good history, very good physical exam. So I was very interested in these issues already. I was primed, if you will, to sort of understand diagnosis. Maybe that's why I never specialized, because internal medicine is a very cognitive specialty. We think a lot about what the patient's diagnosis would be. And then I was thinking of a project in my master's, and I was reading a lot because they had a course on patient safety. So I was able to do some credit hours on patient safety as a part of my master's. And I actually didn't even realize it was a field called patient safety. This is now back in, we're talking 2002, right? So the patient safety movement had just started a few years prior. And lo and behold, I saw a paper by Mark Graber, who is one of the founding fathers of this field, who had written a paper on diagnostic error in academic medicine. And I read the paper and I realized, oh my God, this is what I want to focus on. I have seen patients like this in my practice. I am interested and motivated to sort of take both a cognitive and a systems-based approach. I've understood medicine much better since I finished my residency a few years prior. And I want to focus on dealing with diagnostic errors. And so 2003 onwards, I just applied to a lot of grants trying to get some funding to study diagnostic errors. And one of the points that Mark was making was that there's not a lot of research on the topic. And he wanted more to be done. And it was like a call to action. And, sure enough, that sort of stimulated my career.
So you were there at the right time.
Right time,
With lots of questions, by the sounds of it.
Absolutely.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. So I'd like to talk about error, and specifically error in the context of diagnosis, diagnostic processes. You know, you've mentioned that you started this journey in 2003. So that's, what, nearly a decade and a half of research. Can you just kind of give our listeners some sense of what you mean by diagnostic error and why it is important to study it?
Yeah, so, you know, initially we all had these same questions. So people think, oh yeah, I think I know what diagnostic errors is. What we quickly realize is everybody comes to the topic with a different mental model of what they think is a diagnostic error. So our first few years was very foundational because we were trying to define what's a diagnostic error, which cases are diagnostic errors. When I would say diagnostic error, other people may or may not agree. And what we sort of honed down on was we thought of them as missed opportunities to make a correct and timely diagnosis based on the information that was available to the clinician at that point of time. Mm. So that means we are trying to say that something different could have been done. A lot of this was related to, you know, let's say a patient presents with certain alarm features of perhaps cancer, and you don't take any action on it, or the action gets delayed on it, and the patient gets, you know, a delayed diagnosis of cancer. We would be very explicit in our thinking that something different could have been done earlier in the diagnostic journey of the patients. So one of the sort of almost the hallmarks of our initial sort of, you know, work in this area was trying to come up with what were the use cases of diagnostic errors. So, of course, I talked about things getting missed in history or physical exam, but also testing. So we were seeing all these patients who had had abnormal CAT scans, for instance, or abnormal lab tests that had not been followed up for a long time, or patients who have had an abnormal CAT scan or a chest x-ray that had a little bit of a nodule that needed follow-up. And lo and behold, about a year later, a patient would show up with a cancer. And you look back and see, oh, there was a CAT scan on the same patient from a year and a half ago that had a little nodule that was small, but because we didn't follow up, the diagnosis got missed and delayed. So we started categorizing all of these missed opportunities and came up with sort of here's of how we conceptualize diagnostic errors. Now, you know, everybody has their own definition, so there's several definitions of diagnostic errors, but in our mind, it's truly those missed opportunities to make correct and timely diagnosis based on the available information.
So that's really interesting. So I think what you're qualifying there is the fact that it's not necessarily something that in hindsight, you come to know it's the wrong diagnosis, but actually a missed opportunity based on the collective evidence that you have at the time.
Correct. And that is to try to minimize sort of that hindsight bias that always comes in analyzing cases of diagnostic errors. It's natural to have that hindsight bias because, you know, some of these cases are involving conditions that are really infrequent, they're difficult to diagnose. There's a lot of rare conditions.
It's then actually not looking at the outcome as a judgment of the decisions that were made to get to that outcome. And presumably some diagnoses are diagnoses of exclusion anyway. So by definition, you have to go through a sort of process where you work on the best guess, and but you're gathering more information. You don't have all of the information to make the right decision at that time. And that's very different from what you're describing there, I think. So as a person that's kind of looked at this in detail, then what is the extent of diagnostic error? What's the burden or the impact of this on individuals and the system currently?
This is a hard one to assess because, you know, you need data across different points of time. Oftentimes, healthcare systems, or whether they're clinics, whether they're hospitals, whether they're health systems, they often may not have the complete continuum of data that's needed to make an assessment whether the patient did have a diagnostic error or not. So what we did was we, in systems where we had access to that data, we did some extrapolations and estimations. And we found that about 1 in 20 US adults will have a diagnostic error every year. in the outpatient setting alone. So that's about 5%. When we made that call, we were a little nervous about, you know, that's a pretty big number. Now, you got to remember, not all of these diagnostic errors are harmful, but the number has sort of stood the test of time. We did a study in UK, in fact, with some colleagues out of Manchester, where we found that in sort of the UK setting, it's about 3.5-4%. So it's not too far away from the 5% that we had sort of said. Now, the National Academy of Medicine, which had a landmark report in 2015 about diagnosis, this called Improving Diagnosis in Healthcare, they estimated based on the available literature that every one of us will have at least one diagnostic error, at least once in our lifetime.
And would that be a diagnostic error on the basis of the way that you conceive error? So like missed opportunity, or is this something where the ultimate diagnosis proves not to be the earlier diagnosis?
Their definition is about if the diagnosis or the explanation is not accurate or timely, or the explanation is not communicated to the patient. So they went a step further by sort of categorizing diagnostic errors as also those where you may make the diagnosis, but you didn't communicate it to the patient.
Now, that's really interesting. So I think what you're saying is across multiple different studies and sources, they are sort of triangulating and coalescing around, you know, a reasonable figure that gives you an understanding of what the burden of diagnostic error is in terms of rates. And are there areas of clinical practice that where this happens more than others?
Yeah, we've actually focused on sort of three settings the most. One is diagnostic errors in sort of primary care setting. So we've done some of our work. If you look at that setting, it's a lot of common conditions. So one study that we did, we looked at primary care diagnostic errors, and there were about 190 diagnostic errors in the study that we did. And they involved 67 different types of conditions. None of those conditions was over 6% of the, you know, the diagnostic error cohort, which means there was a lot of common conditions. So diagnostic error occurs, you know, at some frequency. So it's not like any other specialty is, you know, immune from this. Even surgery we've looked at. We looked at cases in Canada in surgery. Even surgery, we find diagnostic errors pre and post and intraoperative. So happens everywhere.
So it's a fairly, if not common, then regular occurrence across all clinical specialties is what I think you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know this is probably a ridiculous question, but what are the main reasons for diagnostic error? What are the things that might be factors in the making or those sorts of missed opportunities to get the right diagnosis?
What we've done is try to understand a lot of those factors. And initially we used to think, oh, there could be system issues, there could be cognitive issues, such as decision-making, biases, heuristics, knowledge gaps. And what we've increasingly realized, it's actually almost always both involved. And it's, you know, just like anything in patient safety, it's very multifactorial. But there's this confluence of systems and cognition that happens. And now we have technology. So we've got systems where we use technology and humans that interact with technology. And so we have to consider decision-making issues. So there's some biases, there's heuristics, knowledge gaps, information interpretation issues, anything to do with data gathering and data interpretation, for instance. I mean, we've seen cases where there was a clear cut problem in the history of the patient. That means either the clinician didn't listen to the patient's story or didn't act on the information that the patient was providing. We've seen cases where there was physical exam findings that should have been picked up, but it wasn't done. So if you're in a very, very busy emergency room setting and you have a lot of patients, lots of interruptions, electronic medical records that don't work very well, you could miss something. You could miss a critical physical exam finding. You could miss a critical lab test. A confluence of factors is what we are finding.
So it's almost like it's your interest is in the situated decision making within a context and all those factors coming together. And I think what you've said is that there's multiple reasons for errors in diagnostic decision making and various biases. I'm also interested in things about like emotion, the degree to which emotion or things like decision fatigue, because I've read once something about how judges in the afternoon make different types of decisions compared to judges in the morning, or if they're hungry, or if they, you know, if it's like 4 p.m. and they've had a long day. Is that been part of your work, looking at those sorts of influences?
Not really, but I've been fascinated with that kind of line of research. I think there wasn't there some research where it said that if you're late in the afternoon, you get more likelihood to get an antibiotic or something like that too. And so, yeah, I think these things play out a lot in our daily lives in the real world. We probably don't have a lot of research to quantify some of the things that you are asking about, but it's needed.
Well, there you go. More work to do. Mm-hmm. But what you've touched on, I think, is some places where you're starting to think about what can be done potentially with specific biases to improve diagnostic decision making. And I read one of your papers with some colleagues around the sorts of ways that at the very least you can set up your team to, you know, to try and plug some of those gaps and counteract some of those biases. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, the first thing, at least for the miscalibration issue that I was describing, and perhaps it's true for other types of biases too, is learning from feedback. Mm. And learning from feedback on your own performance. So take out time and go through your own cases to see, hey, you know, how did you perform in this patient that you saw maybe a few months ago? Mm. Or how have the last, you know, five patients that you have in your practice who got diagnosed with cancer, how did you do? When did you pick up their symptoms? When did you learn from patients about their story? And when did the test get done? Was things done in a timely fashion? So feedback is a big line of our work now. We've actually tried to build sort of structured instruments to try to help clinicians get feedback. That would be one. The second one would be strengthening your knowledge. Knowledge is an extremely effective defense mechanism against many of those biases. Mm. And the more patients you see, the better you get. In fact, in one of our papers, we called for all clinicians to spend, you know, 5 to 10 minutes every day doing some cases. And I think it's called micro-learning now, although we didn't use that word in that paper. But essentially spending some time every day looking at real cases with diagnosis. And we even gave a lot of resources where you can go and look at those cases and, you know, do this bite-sized practice. And what we said in the paper was bite-sized with a B-Y-T-E, because a lot of these cases are digital cases now. So bite-sized practice. You mentioned teams. Absolutely. A lot of clinicians think, oh, it's just me making a diagnosis. And oftentimes, it's a team that makes diagnoses. So there's lots of defense mechanisms that we could use to protect ourselves against some of these biases.
That's fascinating. Thank you. So I was reading some blogs by a guy called Matt Grawich, I think you say his name. He's an American psychologist, and he writes in Psychology Today. And he was talking about how the common understanding now of bias clearly leans towards a sort of negative or derogatory definition. And he was talking about how the definition of bias has changed over time, noting that the current definition in the Merriam-Webster dictionary is an inclination of temperament or outlook, especially a personal and sometimes unreasoned judgment or prejudice. Whereas the original meaning was a leaning of the mind so as to lean or incline from a state of indifference. So under that definition, they simply represent a predisposition to favour a given conclusion. So I guess my question to you is, in terms of diagnostic decision-making, should we always see bias as essentially bad, like a bad thing, or does it come with some upsides in terms of decision-making efficiency, for example?
Yeah, that's an interesting definition, because I agree. You know, we use biases and shortcuts every day, right? In our daily work, we can never be completely unbiased, and we use heuristics, shortcuts in our thinking every day. I think only when I would think that some of the biases that he may be referring to are some of those implicit biases. And I think all of us are using some of these shortcuts and biases every day, it's the specific ones that we need to sort of stay away from. Again, I'm not a cognitive psychologist, so my area in this is quite limited.
I think my interest in this is, I've got a PhD student, and one of the ways that we've looked at bias is in incident reporting and investigation. So we have recently done a paper where we've looked at the impact of outcome bias on how, on judgments of preventability and accountability, and also on the nature of the recommendation. And, you know, in experimental terms, came out with this sort of beautiful pattern of, as expected, of more severe the outcome. Actually, that predisposes people to think that the error was more, or the incident was more avoidable, and that the recommendations are more punitive. So, you know, there's all kinds of sort of ways where bias is implicated, I think, in patient safety, not just in diagnostic error. But I think the way that I'm coming to it, and you've used this term heuristic, is, you know, humans are adapted to make shortcuts, aren't they? We're adapted to say, if we've seen this pattern time and time again, actually more likely than not, it's going to be that thing. So premature closure is bad when it's the wrong thing, but actually could be seen as efficient under another lens. And I suppose that I've got an interest, not just from a sort of healthcare systems point of view, but actually from personal experience, where sometimes you wonder whether health services are actually set up to deal with the time that is necessary sometimes to get to these sort of optimizing decisions rather than satisficing decision-making processes that we have within healthcare. I wonder if that resonates with you as a clinician, as well as somebody that's been.
Yeah, I think I think some of it gets to the uncertainty issue that clinicians deal with. Should I order the test? Should I not order the test? If I order the test, I might be considering, you know, harming the patient because I'm getting a CAT scan on a patient that doesn't require imaging and radiation. But if I don't order the test, I might miss the diagnosis. And so there's this tension every day in daily lives of clinicians about, you know, this uncertainty that we deal with about the next step, when both could be in, you know, right at that point of time, and one of them is going to lead to a better outcome than the other, but you don't know which one it is. And because you don't know what the outcome is going to be. We kind of like that concept of calibration, is because we think if you can focus on the calibration, and if you can getting rid of some of these biases, or at least the negative impact of some of the biases, and keep the positive ones.
And I think to close off this section, I think one of the really interesting things that you've mentioned there is also how often diagnosis is like an individual activity, isn't it? It's a medic sitting in a clinic, you know, without other team members. And I had an experience as a patient, it was about 8 years ago now, and I had what turned out to be post-strep infection. And I had this hideous rash all over me. It was really scary. I thought it was maybe something really awful. And I went to this brilliant rheumatologist, and he sat me there and he was like, well, I was late going in, for starters, and clearly he's doing a really good job because he's actually giving people the time that they need to go through. But on the second time that I was with him, he said, hold on a minute, I'm just going to go next door. And he went next door and he got his dermatologist friend, his colleague, to come in. And he said, we're not supposed to do this. I'm supposed to do an internal referral or whatever it was. And you get that separate consultation with him. And they just were working around the system. And actually, it just meant that my experience was so much better. They were working together to try and make sense of this uncertain diagnosis. And it really, really helped. But they were admitting to me that they weren't supposed to do that in that context, because that wasn't the way that the health service was set up. So it's almost like we're building into our systems things that are problematic for sort of multidisciplinary team diagnostic processes.
Yeah, no, this is the way sometimes system gets in the way. There are system factors. This is where system gets in the way, because I think clinicians should do more of those second opinions, a quick second opinion, no matter how you quickly get it. Are you helping the patient? The fact that your GP sort of realized that he was uncertain and needed help and got a colleague to come and help, that's great. Glad that it sort of worked out, but it doesn't often have it like that, right?
And I think that's it.
A lot of people are like, okay, let me refer you to the dermatologist. It'll be about, you know, 6 weeks for you to get to a dermatologist. And by the time your rash stays, doesn't stay, And there was no point like hospitalizing you because you were not that sick, I believe. And so that was sort of the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. And it was just really interesting that they were very candid about the fact that it was the right thing to do for me, but not the right thing to do necessarily for the system. That's what they shouldn't be doing. So it was kind of actively working against that. But it seems very, very counterintuitive, as you say. I'd like to move us to talk about another area of your sort of interest and expertise, and that's around the development and use of healthcare technologies, and in particular, information technologies and their implications for patient safety. So what do you mean by healthcare kind of information technologies? What sort of things come into that bracket?
So health information technology will include electronic health records, which I think are very widely used, at least in many countries now. We would include things like patient portals, platforms where patients can access information. It would include other things like telehealth and broader sort of applications that are being used to either monitor patients or help patients. A lot of our work has been around either electronic health records or patient portals, where patients can go in and access their test results, for instance. And the reason we started focusing on electronic health records is because, you know, when I was starting out, I was in a system which was using electronic health records, and then US by and large moved to electronic health records after 2010 because of some national policy changes. So we've been, you know, using electronic health records in our country for communication, coordination of care, for documentation, decision support, all of that. So has, you know, a lot of implications for quality and safety.
I did a bit of deep dive into some of your papers on this, you'll be pleased to know, to prepare for today. And in a paper you wrote in 2020 with Dean Sittig and Adam Wright, you said, while recent evidence from inpatient settings shows that health IT can make care safer, it can also create new safety issues, some manifesting long after technology has been implemented. So can you explain a little bit what you mean by that for our listeners and why that's important that we should study it?
So, you know, when we think of technology and patient safety, we have started to think about these three domains where what we are saying is, firstly, the technology has to be safe. Can't be having glitches and bugs and, you know, software problems, because then you can't give care or you can incorrectly dose somebody with a different medicine. Well, actually, this happened in the National Health Service in the UK, I believe it was 2006, because of a computer glitch, 900 people got Viagra instead of Wellbutrin. The only reason they started finding out is women started showing up in pharmacies with Viagra prescriptions. And so it was all a computer glitch. These things can happen anytime. Let's say there's an upgrade. You could have electronic system for 10 years, but there's an upgrade and something goes wrong, right? So that's why, you know, long after technology is important, you got to make sure that, you know, your software is good and safe and reliable. The second bucket we start to think about is use of technology. That means, you know, if we don't integrate technology well into the workflow of the clinician, for instance, and something goes wrong. We have good technology, but we're not using it correctly. Let's say now we have decision support. We have alerts and reminders to clinicians about the drugs they're prescribing or some of their patients' preventive maintenance needs and things like that. Well, if we keep bombarding clinicians with alerts and reminders and they get fatigued, and they start ignoring them, well, that's not good use of technology, right? So you had technology, but now you made it unsafe because I'm ignoring all your warnings because a lot of them were useless and you're sending me too much information. And then the third bucket is using technology to improve patient safety. So one of the main reasons why electronic health records were implemented was to try to improve the quality and safety of care. Right? That's the ultimate goal. So if you want to use technology, you have to make sure it can prevent patient safety events, whether it's diagnostic errors or, you know, falls or infections, whatever it is, we want to try to prevent errors or catch errors before they harm the patient, so on and so forth. So we started conceptualizing these three domains, and we realized there was a lot of work to do because technology implementation had unintended consequences that people weren't thinking about when they were implementing them.
In that paper, you also conclude that the safety of healthcare IT needs to be improved substantially. In the 5 years since publication, do you think there have been improvements?
I mean, generally speaking, we're better at trying to monitor technology, but we're still learning. Now the new kid on the block, for instance, is AI, but the issue is I don't think we've learned enough from health IT implementation unintended consequences, because now I see the same, everybody jumping on the AI bandwagon where, yeah, we'll fix everything with AI. But there's, in the technology hype cycle, if just to clarify, it's a hype cycle where, you know, there's an initial phase of triggering, then there's a phase of excitement and undue expectations, and it's a peak, and then you go flat, and, you know, in the trough, there's this disillusionment. And then slowly you come up to some kind of a plateau of productivity and maintenance. So in the technology hype cycle, this sort of is quite routine. So we had a big hype about electronic health records. Then there was a big disillusionment when everybody started hating them. So now we are slowly getting on to the plateau of productivity where we're getting better. People are also trying to integrate AI on top of it to make it better. So there was a lot of problem with documentation. Clinicians were spending so much time clicking buttons and documenting within these electronic health records. So now AI is supposed to be the big savior. So now health systems are trying to use ambient AI to sort of fix that problem so that AI can help transcribe the patient's notes and let the, you know, clinicians listen into the patient's story. So there's some things that have gotten better for sure, but I think there's a lot of lessons from health IT implementation.
I think everybody, particularly policymakers in the UK, I don't know what it's like in the US, but there's a sort of, you know, push that this is somehow going to revolutionize healthcare and lead to huge cost savings. So it's really interesting to hear you say about the hype cycle. I was reading something about that just yesterday, actually, and thinking that there's certainly lessons that can be learned from the introduction of other types of technologies and how that helps. But I suppose making the link back to bias as well, which is a particular concern, I think, from some communities as well, about are we going to be baking in bias with the use of AI based on, you know, if large language models in particular are using current data, is there a risk that actually we're going to make this things worse for certain communities if the data is wrong, or if they just haven't actually been able to access data from those communities? Do you think that that is a legitimate concern?
Absolutely. I think as far as the excitement on AI, some things I think it's doing really well. And I'll try to use diagnosis as an example. As far as radiology, pathology, some of the visual specialties are concerned, the AI integration has been much more successful. I know of places that are using up-triaging systems where somebody, let's say there's a CAT scan that happens and it shows a bleed in the brain, the AI will do a quick read and then up-triage the CAT scan to the radiologist, saying so that the radiologist can read it immediately rather than read it 2 hours later or 3 hours later, and saying, here's a scan that looks abnormal. And then the radiologist sort of just manually reads the scan and confirms or edits or whatever. So there's good use of AI in those specialties. I think the use of AI to help the clinician in any way, especially from administrative things or documentation requirements, we have a lot of those in the US. There's also, and so I think if you take away some of the inefficiencies of the current health systems and you create time for clinicians to think, that is a good use of AI. Clearly, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I hope that the research infrastructure in whichever country is trying to implement AI is robust enough to make sure that we actually do a great deal of evaluation and consideration of what to do next based on the research.
Well, amen to that. And I think, as you say, we need to be almost considering the introduction of these types of approaches, firstly, as sort of almost complex interventions into a complex system, but also, as you say, learning the lessons and being mindful of the evidence that has come from the work from yourself and others around sort of, you know, the introduction of healthcare information technology more broadly. Okay, so to move us towards the close of my question, so I'm really interested in one of your more recent interests, which is the impact of healthcare on the environment and what can be done to improve and support sustainability. So what do you see as the main issues for sustainability in the context of healthcare and healthcare delivery? And what does this mean in particular for patient safety?
This is my really new passion project for the last about 5 years or so. I've sort of started to gain a lot of interest in the space. I initially was sort of just introduced to this space as, you know, here's something where quality people need to pay attention to because there needs to be leadership in healthcare on climate and sustainability issues. Initially, like, fascinated. I just didn't know how I would connect the dots between my day job of quality and safety and my passion project, sustainability and mitigation. Increasingly, I've realized sort of these three domains. One is environmental issues on people's health. So as clinicians, as quality and safety professionals, we're going to see some of these impacts, whether they are vector-borne diseases or changes based on extreme weather events. We're going to see these. The second is sort of this adaptation and resilience building, where we as health systems and clinicians are going to have to become much more resilient because we're going to be faced with many more climate and extreme weather events than we were before. And third has been sort of the most area active for me, which is sort of environmental sustainability. Like, how does healthcare reduce the impact on the environment? And I became interested on this. There was some work done by now colleagues of mine that show about 8.5% of emissions in the United States are coming from healthcare. So healthcare is quite a significant contributor. And you would think, well, isn't that a small number? Well, let me tell you, aviation is about 2.2%, and we're double that of aviation. And the emissions, people say, well, where do these emissions come from? Because, you know, we don't consume as much electricity and, you know, energy. A lot of these emissions are coming from our supply chain, the devices, the medications, pharmaceuticals, the waste, the water, the food. Everything is related within healthcare delivery. All of that's fair game. And 75 to 80% of those emissions are indirectly related to healthcare delivery. Then I got interested in things like, where can we make mitigation efforts? And that's where low-value care comes in, right? So about 30% of healthcare is wasted / low-value. Can we make a difference in cutting down that part of healthcare so we can reduce our emissions? And the other thing that has been sort of fascinating me the last few years has been waste, and especially plastic waste. Single-use plastics comes to mind because we use a lot of single-use plastics in healthcare. We as quality and safety professionals have what we call sort of the socio-technical lens, where we are very sort of systems-focused people. We deal with people, process, technology, data, culture issues. All of that system transformation needs to happen if our healthcare system needs to become more sustainable. There are trade-offs. You know, you might think that, oh, if we use some reusables, we might be increasing infection risk, even though it may not be true. The cost thing often comes up. Some of these plastic products, single-use plastics, are quite cheap. What people don't realize is a lot of these single-use plastics, in fact, all of them they're all coming from fossil fuels. So 99% of the chemicals that you see in plastics, they're all sort of fossil fuel related. And so there is evidence coming out that there is harm from microplastics and plastics in the environment, and that gets into the body. But what do we do? I mean, there are trade-offs, and we're going to have to make some decisions. And it's funny that you mentioned trade-offs, but we have a paper coming out in a few weeks, and hopefully by the time this is released, the paper will be out, where we discuss some of these trade-offs and we propose a framework to try to for next steps. And one is, you know, there's some areas where there are clear-cut interventions that we should be able to do. So we should proceed with them. There's some areas where we need additional research
and we need more analysis to try to figure out what the right thing to do is. And so we proposed sort of this three-tier approach in a paper coming out and that discusses the trade-offs.
Well, I really look forward to reading that then, because I think this has been something that's been really interesting me recently, is that sort of the trade-offs that we're making. Okay, so as we draw it to a close then, I think one of the main threads in all of our conversation today, and I'm so delighted that you keep bringing this up, has been that clinicians are sort of practicing within a complex system, and that we need to pay attention to this context, this complexity, when we're trying to support them to practice safely. But do you think then, you know, looking back at your career and in patient safety research, do you think we've paid enough attention to context when we're thinking about patient safety initiatives and how they might operate or the implications of them across the multiple layers of the system?
I don't think we paid enough attention to this. In fact, that's why the patient safety field is generally kind of small, right? So when we start talking about these things that you and I consider are socio-technical, most of the time in healthcare, people don't even know what that is and don't understand what context means. And everybody comes up with, here's my solution and here's how I'm going to fix everything. And they forget the context and the socio-technical complex health system that we are all in. I'm hoping that sort of the field is evolving and the field is changing. That's why I love being in sort of patient safety, because of that systems, complex systems approach that is needed for improvement. There's a lot of potential translation to other fields of what we've learned in quality and safety, and, you know, including our successes and failures, right? So we've learned a lot. I believe that we have plenty of lessons here on what to build on. The more we invest in research, the field gets bigger, and I think we need to grow.
Well, again, you're preaching to the choir here. I definitely agree with you. So, Hardeep, I could continue to talk to you for hours. It's been so brilliant to talk to you, but I'm going to have to wrap this up for now. So my kind of final question for you, for our listeners, is based on your career and experience to date, what is the one thing that you hope they take away from this conversation?
I think my biggest takeaway is sort of the socio-technical aspect of healthcare and how difficult it is to conceptualize and intervene. Almost every intervention that we worked on, almost every paper that I've reviewed, almost everybody I've talked to about innovations and implementation, there is this expectation that we'll fix things and it's easy to fix things and it's easy to do some of these projects, and it clearly is not. There is a bit of an implementation gap in what we know and what we do. And the patient safety field suffers from this implementation gap. There are a lot of known best practices in patient safety that are still not being implemented. So I would say two sides of the coin. One is sort of this stuff is complex, and that's why it takes time. And the second is, well, some situations we know what to do, so let's do them. So there's lots of pragmatic tools and resources and interventions in patient safety that have been developed but have not been implemented, and we need to make sure that we close that implementation gap.
Well, Hardeep, what a wonderful way to finish this conversation that we've had. I've so enjoyed speaking to you today. Thank you so much for so generously giving so much of your time.
Well, pleasure being here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. We hope you have enjoyed this episode, and do check out the others in this 6-part series. The series is funded by the National Institute for Health and Care Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. The views expressed by the guests are their own and do not represent those of the NIHR or the Department of Health and Social Care.